This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Linda Kenyon. The White House says it is cautiously optimistic about a ceasefire in Gaza, while Israel has approved a ground operation in Rafah. CBS's Chris Livesay spoke to an Israeli Special Forces lieutenant colonel.
Are you worried that you might win the ground war but lose the information war?
I have my worries, yeah. But today, my mission is to make sure that we are finishing this war and there is no threat for our kids.
An Indian Navy warship has intercepted the hijacked cargo ship Ruwan and demanded the Somali pirates on board surrender. The pirates, who took over the Maltese flag cargo vessel in December, opened fire on the Navy ship in international waters. Until the Ruwan was seized, there had been no successful hijacking of a merchant ship by Somali pirates since 2017. At least three people have been killed after a series of tornadoes tore through the central U.S. WTTV reporter Eric Graves spoke to this Indiana resident.
It's gone. Everything's gone.
The home he left Thursday afternoon is now just a foundation. Nick was at work when the storm threw his house all over the neighborhood.
I don't even know where the bathtub is, because if I was home, there's no way I'd be here. There is no way.
Nick's starting to clean up right now, focused on finding his car keys.
Most of the things that actually cost any money or worth anything are gone.
Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade has resigned in the Georgia election interference case against former President Trump. A judge ruled either Wade or Fulton County DA Fonnie Willis would have to go after their romantic relationship. CBS's Dan Kladman on what Willis must now do to repair her reputation and win the case.
Not to make any more mistakes and unforced errors, as this certainly was, and to do her work inside the courtroom, which, by the way, will be televised, so the whole world can see how well prepared she is for this case and what a professional she is.
The FAA is investigating the loss of an external panel from a United Airlines jet. Details from WTOP's Dan Ronan.
United Flight 433 was a 737-800. It left San Francisco and arrived without incident at the Rogue Valley International Airport in Medford, Oregon. But an external panel that's on the belly of the airplane was missing. It was discovered missing during a routine post-flight inspection. The crew did not declare an emergency. It appears they were unaware the plane was missing the part during their flight. Dan Ronan for CBS News, Washington.
Waiting to hear if anyone has claimed the Mega Millions jackpot.
Our first winning number tonight is 50. That's followed by 13. Up next, we have 66.
If there is no winner, the jackpot would rise to $815 million. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Wisconsin's healthcare workforce is in critical but stable condition. That's according to an annual industry group report. Mike Moan has more.
Annual findings from the Wisconsin Hospital Association show that health systems around the state have made some hiring gains following some worrisome years. However, job vacancy rates are at double digits for 8 of 18 health professions, and registered nurses just moved into that territory. WHA's Ann Zink says that's concerning for a key reason.
Registered nurses make up over half of the hospital and health system workforce. So that's very impactful because nurses can fill other gaps on the healthcare team.
Wisconsin is projected to see one out of every four residents reach retirement age by 2030, putting more pressure on demand for services. Providers and state officials are carrying out efforts to reduce staffing turnover in healthcare. The report has specific recommendations, including regulatory changes and expanded use of technology to help see patients. In the meantime, Zhang says the current challenges will be noticed by healthcare consumers.
People have to wait longer for a primary care appointment or a specialty appointment. Sometimes they end up needing to come to an urgent care department or an emergency department to get that access.
Zhang says that creates busier waiting rooms for those settings. And the report's authors say clinics are having a harder time filling certain support staff positions, such as medical assistants and receptionists. As for the bright spots, the WHA says there are more physicians in Wisconsin than there were a decade ago. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, partly sunny with highs in the mid-50s. It'll be breezy out of the west, up to 30 miles per hour at times. For tonight, partly cloudy, breezy, 28. More clouds for Sunday. We'll see a high near 37. Monday, partly sunny. Again, highs around 37.
Currently, 42 degrees.
Your home for the Devil's Advocates. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome back to this, our second hour here on this Saturday morning, March 16th, 2024. Delighted to have you with me and with my wonderful producer, Johnny, here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. As always, taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. I'm going to get to some of those phone calls later in this, our second hour of our morning broadcast. As always, reviewing, surveying, analyzing, summarizing those major events and stories in the areas of government and law and the aspiration for justice in America. We spent most of our first hour talking about what's going on in Manhattan, the certainty that the so-called hush money case there is not going to be going to trial as we anticipated in about 9 days from now. That is a significant change based upon the late production of evidence and of discovery in that matter. Lots of explaining to do before the judge coming up on the 25th of March. We went now to Georgia, where again, in that case, also some significant developments that affect the future of that prosecution as well. We talked at great length about the dismissal by Judge Scott McAfee of six of the solicitation charges, if you will, based upon his determination that they were not specifically particularized to let the defendant know what it is that they were charged with. Fannie Willis has some options to pursue on that. And now talking about this major decision that dropped just yesterday, in which Scott McAfee, again, in a related but different set of facts and circumstances, find that indeed the defense motion to disqualify her based upon this personal relationship, financial transactions between her and her principal prosecutor in this case, his name is Nathan Wade, that does not provide a sufficient basis in which to disqualify her and therefore denies the defense motion, but says that one of two things have to happen. Either if she is not disqualified, he has got to go, or she needs to leave the case, as presumably the Fulton County DA's office generally would. She plainly chooses yesterday afternoon to stay on the case, keep her office there, and Nathan Wade resigns, the special ADA that she hired, with whom she had a personal relationship. Again, the focus of this order, finding as a matter of law and fact, no conflict of interest specifically to warrant disqualification, but an awful lot to suggest that what was going on inside the office, this personal relationship, which again did not have an impact upon the prosecution, nonetheless gives people pause and prompts people to think about the quality, the integrity of the prosecution itself. And so Judge McAfee, in his 23-page order, describes all of that, setting forth the standards, the facts and circumstances, a lot of information about what happened in the course of the 2.5-day hearing, the evidentiary hearing, and finds in the end, that a special assistant DA's oath of office, he's talking about Nathan Wade here, in combination with supervision, theoretically, and this is important, theoretically provided by a neutral and detached district attorney, somebody who can supervise him, with whom he does not have a relationship, should generally be sufficient to dispel the appearance of improper incentive, okay? Nor would a romantic relationship, he says, between prosecutors standing alone typically implicate disqualification, assuming neither prosecutor had the ability to pay the other as long as the relationship persisted. But in combination, he says, which is what we got here, alleged by the defendants, there's a prima facie case, a case that on its face may indicate there's something to look at here. It raises issues about financial enrichment and improper motivations, which inevitably and unsurprisingly invites a motion such as this. So he says, you know what, I'm going to find that there's no disqualification basis, but an awful lot of fire here, producing smoke also, and prompting me to look more deeply into all of this. Describes in great detail some of the testimony about the relationship between the DA and Reid traveling together on four occasions that resulted in some of the documented expenses were part of this very, very extensive testimonial evidentiary hearing. He said such a reimbursement practice where the money is exchanged between the two of them may be unusual, and the lack of any documentary corroboration understandably concerning. Yet the testimony withstood direct contradiction, he says. It was corroborated by other evidence and was not so incredible as to be inherently unbelievable. However, he says, as the DA herself acknowledged, no ledger exists, and other than a best guesstimate, there is no way to be certain that expenses were split completely evenly. Again, he's focusing upon, at the invitation of the defense, to look more closely at the nature of this relationship inside the office, not in the courtroom, not in the public domain, having to do with finances and the relationship. In the end, he says this: the court finds, based largely on the district attorney's testimony, that the evidence demonstrated that the financial gain flowing from her relationship with Wade was not a motivating factor on the part of the district attorney to indict and prosecute the case. That's key. That's fundamental, right? The relationship exists, but it wasn't a motivating factor. While a general motive, he goes on to say, for more income can never be disregarded entirely, the financial issue means something, that's what he's saying. The district attorney was not financially destitute throughout this in time or in any great need. As she testified, that her salary exceeds $200,000 per year without any indication of excessive expenses or debts. In other words, she wasn't doing this for the money. No indication that the evidence shows that is at all. Certainly, the court finds that the defendants have failed to demonstrate that the DA's conduct has impacted, and this is key also, has impacted or influenced the case to the defendant's detriment. In other words, this is going on. It's not good. It should have been taken care of, shouldn't have happened, but no detriment, no impact upon the defendants themselves, nothing having to do with the actual prosecution of this case. While prejudice is not a required element for disqualification, he says, it is relevant to consideration of due process and the defendant's requested remedy of complete dismissal. And he opens up that door then. What's going to happen here? Is this an appropriate basis upon which to dismiss the case entirely? He goes on to say, defendants argue the financial arrangement created an incentive to prolong the case, but in fact, there is no indication on this record, he says, that the DA is interested in delaying anything. Indeed, he says, the record is quite to the contrary. Before the relationship came to light, the state requested that the trial begin less than 6 months after the indictment. Again, nothing to suggest that her official conduct was problematic or that she was motivated in some way that had an impact upon prejudice the defendant in some way. This relationship, the financial goings back and forth, those things did not have an impact upon the prosecution itself. And so the judge finds, without sufficient evidence, the DA acquired a personal stake in the prosecution or that her financial arrangements had any impact on the case, the defendant's claims of an actual conflict must be denied. And he gets it right. As we often said, there is no indication of an actual conflict of interest here. But he goes on to say this, and this opens up the second portion, which is very critical of Fani Willis and what she has done here. The finding is by no means an indication that the court condones, as he describes, this much in the media in the past 24 hours. He describes it as a tremendous lapse in judgment or the unprofessional manner of the district attorney's testimony during the evidentiary hearing. He's sitting right there looking at her, and he concludes that her testimony, the nature of it, the manner of her description, the manner of her testimony, her demeanor on the stand, was unprofessional as a prosecutor held to these much higher standards. Rather, it is this court's opinion that Georgia law does not permit the finding of an actual conflict for simply making bad choices. Indeed, that's what the law is in Georgia and other places. Even if those bad choices are repeated, he says, and it's the trial court's duty to confine itself to relevant issues and applicable law properly brought before it. He says there are other forums that may also discuss this and address it. The General Assembly, the Ethics Commission, the State Bar of Georgia, the Fulton County Board of Commissioners, the voters of Fulton County, all sorts of other remedies out there. Then they may, he actually invites sort of their review of what's going on here, doesn't necessitate her being removed because there's no actual conflict of interest, but says that that doesn't end the inquiry. And this is where it gets very critical of her. And this is the reason why it's been a bad week for Fani Willis. Says that the appellate courts have endorsed the application of an appearance of impropriety standard to state prosecutors even without any explicit finding of an actual conflict. The appearance of impropriety is generally considered conduct or status, he says, that would lead a reasonable person to think that the actor is behaving or will be inclined to behave inappropriately or wrongfully. The appearance standard, the judge goes on to say, recognizes that even when no actual conflict exists, a perceived conflict in the reasonable eyes of the public, and that's what Judge McAfee is focusing on now. How does the public look at all of this? A conflict, a perceived conflict in the reasonable eyes of the public threatens confidence in the legal system itself. That confidence is what Judge McAfee is concerned about. When this danger goes uncorrected, it undermines the legitimacy and moral force of our already weakest branch of government. Yes, that's identified as the judiciary. Question in these days whether the judiciary is the weakest branch, but nonetheless, that is often the mantra, the description given the judiciary in our nation. One final observation, he said, can be gleaned from the appellate review of these standards. The remedy can vary. The remedy can vary, and he identifies that early on because he wants to open up the door to alternatives that he has short of dismissal, short of throwing Fani Willis in the DA's office off the case. And indeed, he just does just that. He says, unlike an actual conflict, the finding of an appearance of impropriety does not automatically demand disqualification, nor would the finding of an appearance of impropriety on the part of the DA herself, in contrast to an actual conflict, necessarily result in the disqualification of the entire office. And so he announces, as he gets into this issue of appearance of impropriety, that this matter, serious, problematic, and yes, a huge problem, the HR problem, this personnel problem inside the office, which he takes note of and condemns and criticizes and expresses his own form of judicial disappointment about, nonetheless, doesn't require complete disqualification. In the end, he says, with these principles in mind, the court finds that the record made at the evidentiary hearing established that the DA's prosecution is encumbered by an appearance of impropriety. That is not good news for Fani Willis. Plainly, she does not agree with that, nor did she feel that was the conclusion based upon her testimony. When we come back, we're going to tell you more about what the judge had to say about her testimony, finding it unprofessional, and specifically what she needs to do to clean this up, or somebody needs to do to clean up the internal matter that he has now identified in this order.
Is the Shaw, WAUK.
Most of us can agree we should have the freedom to make our own medical decisions. Politicians should have no role at all, but not California mega millionaire Eric Hovde. Hovde said, I am totally opposed to abortion, and I'm 100% pro-life. And he supported overturning Roe v. Wade, the court case that protected abortion rights. Hovde's been supported by Wisconsin Right to Life, an extreme anti-abortion group that supports banning abortion, even in cases of rape and incest, and threatens doctors and nurses with criminal charges for providing abortion care. With views like that, Hovde could be a crucial vote in favor of a national abortion ban, letting politicians decide what's right for women. Call Eric Hovde at his California office at 714-730-4444. Tell him his position on abortion is dangerous for Wisconsin women. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Decision coming out of the trial court in Fulton County, authored by the judge. His name is Scott McAfee. Going through that in some microscopic detail, microscopic justice this morning, understanding what he said and what he did not say that resulted in this decision by Nathan Wade, the special assistant district attorney, the lead prosecutor in that case yesterday afternoon to resign, no longer a part of the case. One of the alternatives given by the judge to Fannie Willis, either she's got to go, the DA's office has got to go generally, or he has got to go, and he chooses to leave as a result of this order. The court going through in great detail this decision to find that there is no conflict of interest. That's right. There isn't. We knew that from the start. That was very, very clear. But finding nonetheless that under Georgia law, the appearance of impropriety can compromise the course of justice and can affect the public's perception. And as a result of that, determining, as he did, that the record at the evidentiary hearing, that the DA's prosecution, all that she has done, including her own testimony, is encumbered by exactly that, an appearance of impropriety. And that's what animates him to do exactly what he did. Very important language. And again, he is delving into the HR problems, the personnel issues, which should have been taken care of a long time ago, and effectively cleaning this up, if you will, from the bench. Matters that should have been taken care of inside the DA's office, which are problematic, undeniably, as we have always said. He says this appearance is not created by mere status alone, but comes because of specific conduct and impacts more than a mere nebulous public interest because it concerns a public prosecutor. That is his notion once again. Doing this work on behalf of the people have a right to have confidence in what's going on. And if that is compromised in some way, the judge, the prosecutor, everybody involved has an interest in ensuring that the public has confidence in that process. And here is some of the most important language that I identified when I read this order because of my own involvement in supervising situations inside offices where there are romantic relationships or ties between prosecutors. One of the most fundamental things, it can happen, and it does, in fact, take place all the time inside of offices, including prosecution offices. But one of the fundamental HR principles is that if indeed one of those people in the relationship is a supervisor, he or she plainly cannot supervise, that is, review the conduct, review the professional behavior, the accomplishments of the very person with whom they have a romantic relationship. That applies, of course, not just in prosecution offices. That applies across the board in private and public offices. If you are a supervisor, you should not be supervising someone with whom you have a relationship, a partnership in your personal life. And so the judge basically says just that. He says, even if the romantic relationship began after Wade's initial contract in November 2021, and again, an awful lot of information in this order, spends a lot of time talking about the timing of when this relationship began, determines in the end that nobody can be quite clear about when it is. The testimonial evidence is not clear on when it began. Basically, he says in the end, it's not really relevant. I don't care, he says, so much about when this started. What he does say is the district attorney chose to continue supervising and paying Wade while maintaining such a relationship. That is a personnel criticism. That's a personnel condemnation of his about how she is handling her own office. She further allowed the regular and loose exchange of money between them without any exact or verifiable measure of reconciliation. Again, the kind of thing that an HR director or maybe another supervisor in the office would address. This lack of confirmed financial split creates the possibility and appearance that the district attorney benefited, albeit non-materially, from a contract whose award lay solely within her purview and policing. And then goes on to say this: most importantly, were the case allowed to proceed unchanged, the concerns raised by the defendants would persist. As the DA herself testified, her relationship with Wade has only cemented after these motions and is stronger than ever. And then goes on to describe Wade. He says, Wade's patently unpersuasive explanation for the inaccurate interrogatories, that's a discussion about the discovery, the answers he provided earlier, he submitted in his pending divorce in matter, indicates a willingness on his part to wrongfully conceal his relationship with the DA. As the case moves forward, the judge says, reasonable members of the public could easily be left to wonder whether the financial exchanges have continued, resulting in some form of benefit to the DA, or even when the relationship, romantic relationship, has resumed. Put differently, an outsider could reasonably think that the DA is not exercising her independent professional judgment, totally free of compromising influences. As long as Wade remains in the case, this unnecessary perception will persist. That's the language. That's the language right there that prompts Nathan Wade yesterday to resign. And indeed, he does exactly that. The court goes on to say he doesn't place a lot of credence in testimony. Remember this testimony of this fellow named Terrence Bradley, comments generally about how the evidentiary presentation by the defense, by the prosecution, was not clear. But in the end, he says it has an odor of mendacity, meaning untruthfulness. People may have been lying during the course of this proceeding. The court is not under an obligation, the judge says, to address every single instance of potential dishonesty, but. Reasonable questions about the DA and her hand-selected assistant DA testifying untruthfully about the timing of the relationship further underpin the finding of an appearance of impropriety and the need to make proportional efforts to cure it. He's referencing once again the fact that he's got alternatives here. Doesn't need to throw everything out. He's got proportional efforts to cure it and indeed does just that. He also addresses forensic misconduct. Identifies along the way a speech that Fannie Willis gave on January 14th of 2024. He said in these public and televised comments, the district attorney complained that a Fulton County commissioner and so many others questioned her decision and describes there the danger of public comment by a prosecuting attorney. By including a reference, he says, to others on the heels of this motion, the DA left open the question for the public to consider, and the court finds, after considering all of that, the speech that did include Defendant Roman and his counsel within its ambit, whether intentional or not, was also improper. At best, it can divine, under the sole direction of the authority in the state of Georgia, that the court cannot find the speech cross the line to the point where the defendants have been denied the opportunity for a fundamentally fair trial, or that requires the disqualification of the DA. In other words, I find this problematic. I don't like what the DA has said publicly in the context of her official capacity, but it doesn't cross the line, doesn't deprive the defendants, including Roman, including Donald Trump, of his right to a fair trial. But it was legally improper. That's the judge coming to that conclusion. That public comment, he says, creates dangerous waters for the DA to wade further into, and then gives this admonition. He said, the time may well have arrived for an order preventing the state from mentioning the case in any public forum to prevent prejudicial pretrial publicity, but that is not the motion before the court. I'm not doing that today. That could come down the road. Again, proposing perhaps a gag order on the state if that continues. He's not doing that today. In the end, he says, whether this case ends in convictions, acquittals, or something in between, the result should be one that instills confidence in the process. A reasonable observer, he says, unburdened by partisan blinders, should believe that the law was impartially applied, that those accused of crimes had a fair opportunity to present their defenses, and that any verdict was based on our criminal defense system's best efforts at ascertaining the truth. The evidence of appearance of impropriety remains and must be handled
even as this matter goes forward. All of that from the pen of Judge Scott McAfee, issued just yesterday, changing once again somewhat the geography.
Keeping Southeast Wisconsin informed, engaged, and entertained. This is The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. Ceasefire talks are set to resume this weekend in Israel's war on Hamas, but a UN spokesman says if Israel attacks Rafah and Gaza as planned,
consequences of a ground operation in Rafah in the current circumstances would be catastrophic.
At least three people are dead after a series of tornadoes in the Midwest, and CBS's Roxana Sabiri says searches for victims are ongoing.
All around us, we see the contents of entire homes, mattresses, there's an ice box or a cooler, we see clothes.
A special prosecutor who had a romantic relationship with Fulton County DA Fani Willis has withdrawn from former President Trump's Georgia election interference case.
He had to. There was no way that it was going to be the elected district attorney of Fulton County, Fani Willis, who was going to step down. After this decision came out, it was always going to be Nathan Wade.
That's CBS News legal contributor Jessica Levinson. CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keys.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
It's the Badgers and the Boilermakers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Wisconsin Badgers playing the number one seed in the Big Ten tournament today, Purdue. Wisconsin played them last Sunday, losing by 8. What makes the Badgers think that they're ready this time? Head coach Greg Gard.
I think getting healthy was a big piece of it. And I mean, the stars have been in different parts of our team throughout the year. You know, Chucky had big games. Max has had big games. AJ has one today. John had one yesterday. But I've always felt the real strength of this, the ace of this team, has been their depth. That spark comes from specifically Cam and John.
In the Big East tournament, Marquette with another win, this time over Providence, 79-68. The Golden Eagles tip off tonight at Madison Square Garden against UConn. NFL, the Packers introduced their new running back, Josh Jacobs, after leaving the Raiders.
Ultimately, it came down to what I seen and what I felt like I believed in this team, the history of this organization, and feeling like I'm wanted by our organization. That's really what it came down to.
That's running back Josh Jacobs. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, partly sunny with highs in the mid-50s. It'll be breezy out of the west, up to 30 miles per hour at times. For tonight, partly cloudy, breezy, 28. More clouds for Sunday. We'll see a high near 37. Monday, partly sunny. Again, highs around 37.
Currently, 42 degrees.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
How to avoid this apocalyptic nightmare? It's to vote. Because at the end of the day, the only thing that will save our democracy is our democracy. America, make your voice heard. Turn away from authoritarianism and vote this November.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it. Navigating without a compass, eyes waiting, started to wonder. Metamorphosis, the loss of who you thought you was.
When your kid can't find the language, help them find the lyrics. Listen to the Sound It Out album and get tips and tools to start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Nightline with Pete Schwabba.
Sam Neill talked about being at the Jurassic Park premiere in London with his 10-year-old son and sitting next to Princess Diana. Apparently, Sam Neill's son had really bad gas through the whole premiere. His biggest fear was that Princess Di thought it was him, and he didn't say anything. He did not out his son. I think that's so cool.
That's a great dad right there.
That's a great dad.
Nightline with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
your home of the Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings from 8 till 10 on The Shaw. 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
We are back talking this morning about these cases, these trials brought against Donald Trump, a present candidate for the presidency of the United States of America, and talking in great detail. Some microscopic justice this morning, reviewing, analyzing this major decision by Scott McAfee, the judge in the Georgia case, finding no reason to disqualify, no actual conflict of interest warranting the removal of Fannie Willis or her office, but finding that the appearance of impropriety is sufficient to prompt something to happen here. And that is, as we saw yesterday, the decision by Nathan Wade, this principal lead prosecutor, to resign in the interest of justice, in the interest of rule of law, and a follow up on all of the things that the judge said in his order. A significant ruling, again, doesn't impact, as does the decision earlier in the week by him to dismiss some charges, doesn't impact the content, the substance of the prosecution, but certainly affects what is a significant issue in and of its own right, which is the status, the integrity of the prosecutor herself in this case. And Fannie Willis not only needs to address now these dismissed charges that are out there, but also needs now to address and find a way forward to ensure that the professionalism that the judge has identified is missing from this case, at least in this aspect of it, needs to be restored. And that is the task in front of her. That is the task in front generally of her office as this case goes forward. Take some inventory. Is there a trial date in this? No, there isn't. Is there a trial date right now in the New York case we discussed earlier in this broadcast? The answer is no. Is there a trial in the Mar-a-Lago case, a trial date set in the Mar-a-Lago case? Similarly, we're going to chat about that in just a few moments. No. Is there a trial date set in this principal election interference case pending in the Federal District Court in the District of Columbia? The answer there is no as well. Why? Because there, the Supreme Court, again, addressing this issue of immunity and legitimacy of some of the charges against Donald Trump. Right now, on this morning, Saturday, March 16th, with respect to all of these four criminal cases, the state cases, the criminal cases, no trial dates, increasingly likely, not certain that any one of them will be tried before the election in November. And that is a matter, of course, for attention, not only by voters, but also concern by anyone who's concerned about the movement forward of cases like this, the criminal justice system generally. And as Judge Scott McAfee said, the integrity of the system, the perception of the court system by the public, all important in America. As always, we appreciate your phone calls, your comments, your questions at 844-967-2789. A lot covered already this morning. Looking forward to more of that in the remaining time of this broadcast. Delighted to have some callers calling in with their comments or questions. Let's begin with David. David and Mequon, appreciate your being part of our program this morning.
Thank you, James, for taking my call this morning. I'm not sure. Are you familiar with a gentleman named Victor Davis Hanson by chance?
I don't know that I am. Tell me about him.
Okay. All right. Well, he's with the Hoover Institute, and he's a conservative, but an intellectual conservative. Mm-hmm. And he actually is discussing the same thing that you did this morning, actually on X. And he talks about it, and he just said, he headlines on X, he goes, "No law left in America from Willis to her." So he kind of lays out the case, basically saying that what would it take for her to get a prosecutor disqualified because she lied under oath. You have three, not just two witnesses contradict her sworn testimony, have 30 or 40 more telephone pings belly her testimony of her whereabouts, have, say, emails in addition to the current text of an associate contradicting almost everything she said. In other words, nullified the evidence before him and removed the less culpable of the two guilty parties, given all these illegalities originated with Willis herself. Is there still a law against perjury and fraud, or does ideology and race now determine guilt or innocence in America?
You know, right? And David, appreciate very much the comment. Obviously, this is what we do in America, right? We talk about the merits of cases. I would commend to you and all the listeners, including Victor David Hansen, as he plainly has done, a review of the courts wrestling with this. And that's why we have judges who are human beings, right? All of us, if we were judges, may have different perspectives, may approach this differently. And this judge says, you know what? I'm highly troubled by what I see. I'm troubled by the evidence that is presented before me. And although he says in the end, I can't make heads or tails about all this conflicting evidence, he does not find perjury. He doesn't find that people overtly lied. He said it's got this air of mendacity. Something about it doesn't sound just right. But in the end, he says, all of this leads me to believe that there is no reason to get rid of the prosecutor, but you've got this major, major problem. And again, I think that your comment and that of Victor David Hansen reflects the notion that we should all be looking at this opinion. We don't necessarily have to agree with it, but we have a system where we have judges and we call upon them to make not just judgment calls, but apply the facts to the law and come to the very best judgment that they possibly can. That's what Judge McAfee did here. Appreciate very much the comment, David, and the observation. First Amendment America, we all talk about these things as we do on this radio broadcast. And I thank you very much for your view on that as well, David. Mark is also calling in this morning. Mark, your comment or question about all the things we're talking about this morning.
Yeah, it's tough to nail down just one particular thing. On the case in New York, where the evidence was not forthcoming when it should have been forthcoming, a suspicious part of me in my old auditor's brain wonder if somebody in the Trump contact sphere that said, well, hold on to this stuff and we'll use this as a tool to, you know, delay again. And in the case down in, you know, Fulton County, where, yes, it was a bad decision there. I don't know whether she lied or not, or her knowledge of the chain of events, you know, in the relationship, you know, how many times the phone calls were pinged, because if you might be within a mile of somebody and not be in contact with those people, your phones are still in the same place, you know, that within a mile of each other. And that's no clear indication to me that they're actually in contact with each other on the phone at that particular time. But the point is that Michael Roman and his fellow co-defendants in this case committed a nationwide conspiracy to deprive me and my fellow citizens of our electoral rights guaranteed under the 14th Amendment in Section 2. In furtherance, as I've stated before, this is all part of a vast conspiracy to overturn the last election. And you just can't get away from that. And Josh Call should actually pick up the exact case that Fannie Willis has, you know, with the documentation she's developed down in Georgia, and pick it up here in the state of Wisconsin. Because, as we heard Andrew Hitt say, he claimed on 60 Minutes, well, I felt threatened and all this. But now taped evidence has come out. I don't know if it was videotape or audio tape of them at that meeting after they signed the fake electoral documents back in December of 2020, that they're high-fiving and cheering and applauding each other for their conspiracy against the people of the state of Wisconsin. Sure.
And Mark, lots and lots of things to unpack there as you are doing. Let me just pick one of those and say that, yes, indeed, some people describe the entire Fannie Willis matter as a sideshow. It isn't just that, right? It does go, as the judge said, to the integrity of the process there. It is a pretrial motion, which, again, defendants have a right to bring forward. But to your very good point, which I agree with entirely, it doesn't change the landscape of this case. And the principal allegations in that RICO indictment, that sweeping indictment, are, much as it is in the federal case, the interference case as well, an attempt, Mark, as you just said, to not only undermine our election, to steal the votes, to affect the results of the 2020 election, and to do it in a way that's in violation of Georgia law and in New York law and arguably federal law as well when that case goes to trial. That's the big picture issue, right? And one of the concerns about the present status of all these cases is that we may not get resolution on any of them, including these interference cases, until after this election. An awful lot of people in America looking for some ultimate decision by a jury of peers, determining beyond what a grand jury has already determined that there is indeed evidence to support a finding beyond a reasonable doubt of a conviction or not, increasingly less likely that any of these cases will go to trial before we all go into the voting booths in August and November and go ahead and attempt to resolve all of this in the electoral process as well. We've got other callers calling in. Appreciate that very much as well. Kristen from Waukesha. Kristen, thanks for being with me this morning. How are you today? We've got Kristen on the line. Yes. Is Kristen there? Is she? Okay. Well, Kristen, I think, is on the line. Yes. Kristen?
Okay.
Okay. Now very good. I can hear you now. Great. Thank you so much.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Kristen.
I just can't get over the strange misogyny of this case. I mean, essentially, you've got two people, one of whom is a supervisor, having a relationship. Right. That, to me, that's the issue. That's the problem.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of different things where she could be not supervising his work correctly because she's in love with him. I get it. But for them to break this down as a monetary thing is what kills me. She is an independent woman making a great salary and an important job, and they think she's in this for the money?
Right.
And they're scrutinizing, you know, did he buy you flowers once? Did he ever buy you lunch? I mean, it's just so stupid. That's the part that really gets
right,
me.
Right.
I agree that this the appearance of impropriety is the issue. They should have, put this relationship on the back burner until this case was over. I get it. It's they fell in love. They couldn't help themselves. Whatever. But it's the making it about money thing just kills me.
And
she did not need his money.
She didn't.
She's not in this for the money.
Right. And the judge specifically finds just that. He says, this is her salary. It's $200,000 per year. This relationship was not a motivating factor in any way. This is on page 8 of the opinion. Makes it very clear. It says general motive for can never be disregarded. But that's not here. And there's no showing, no demonstration that this conduct in any way was motivated by financial interests. And I think you're right, Kristen. That's exactly what the focus of this has been all along from the start, as we have discussed before. This notion that somehow there's this financial connection leads to a conflict of interest has always not just been attenuated, but almost non-existent. So my perspective is just as yours, that the basic force of the motion, the arguments being made by Roman's attorney and others, just didn't have a there, right? And the judge basically says that and then goes on, as you and I have just spoken, as we reported this morning, to find that while all this does not result in disqualification, these other issues, it shouldn't have happened. But it is a personnel matter. It is internal, as I've said, and the supervision issue is a concern, as you've also underscored. And so, Kristen, thank you very much for your comment this morning. Always, always insightful as we think and go forward then with yet another case. We were in New York, in Georgia, and most recently here. And now we're going to Florida. We're going to go a little bit further south, not too much further south, into Florida and talk about the Mar-a-Lago documents case. Yes, indeed, that's still pending. And as I said before in the inventory, no clear trial date on that matter either. Donald Trump, among several defendants there, not only for improperly, illegally taking, acquiring, keeping documents in the course of his departure from the presidency, keeping those in Mar-a-Lago, arguably New Jersey as well. And the Supreme Court there, of course, not weighing in on that case, weighing in on the other case involving election interference in District of Columbia. What is going on there is, of course, like the other cases, is pretrial motions. And there again, Judge Eileen Cannon, they're entertaining various pretrial motions from Donald Trump. The focus of those, again, is premised upon allegations that, number one, the special counsel had no authority to do what he's doing, that the attorney general's position in support of his appointment was invalid, that Donald Trump himself is immune from prosecution, the same issue that is before the Supreme Court right now. And also, these are personal records, and therefore the statute doesn't apply to him. Indeed, just on Thursday of this week, another major decision coming out of Eileen Cannon, shutting down one of Donald Trump's efforts to derail that documents case, overseeing this case, rejecting one of those principal motions to have the case dismissed. And this is the first time she's denied a legal attack on the indictment. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about exactly what that's all about and more. Stay with us. Thank you.
listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
All eyes will be on Wisconsin when the NFL brings the 2025 Player Selection Draft to the state. 250,000 visitors are expected. Here's Green Bay Mayor Eric Genrich.
You know, maybe we don't have as many hotel rooms as a Kansas City or a Detroit, but I think it's going to be incredibly positive, not just for Green Bay, but the state as a whole.
It's the second time Wisconsin hosted the draft, the first in 1939. Do you know where? Oshkosh, Milwaukee, or Madison? The answer coming up.
It's really our obligation to pull people out of that campus when the draft activities aren't going on to make sure that they see all the sites that we have within our downtown and other places.
And with the main draft campus around Lambeau Field, it's a time for the whole area to shine. Now, did you guess the Wisconsin location for the 1939 draft? It was a one-day event in Milwaukee with the NFL championship game the next day. The Packers beat the Giants 27-0. There's a winning slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Shaw, WAUK.
We are back talking about yet another case. This is the Mar-a-Lago case. This is the documents case pending in the district court in Florida. Eileen Cannon, just this week, shutting down one of Donald Trump's pretrial motions, attacking that case, asking that it be dismissed, the classified documents and presidential documents case. She basically says in a 2-page order, rebuffing arguments by Donald Trump and his lawyers, that the central statute in the indictment, so-called the Espionage Act, was impermissibly vague and should be struck down entirely. Struck down, therefore, the entire indictment needs to go away. She dismisses that, does this following a nearly day-long hearing in Fort Pierce, Florida, where she entertained arguments about all of this. The government, of course, says that the former president in this case violated the law 32 times by removing these large numbers of highly sensitive documents from the White House after he left office. In her order, Judge Cannon acknowledges that Trump's lawyers have raised various arguments warranting serious consideration, but adds that their concerns about the Espionage Act were better made in connection with jury instruction briefing, dismissing that notion right now, arguably opening up the door down the road for this to be returned to her attention down the road. Along the way, dismissing basically this notion that somehow Donald Trump had a personal right to these documents. These were his personal documents, as opposed to what we know they actually are, which are documents owned by who? By the people of the United States of America, by our government. That's what the Espionage Act and the other cases indicate in this particular prosecution. Other matters related to selective prosecution, this immunity issue and authority issue, all those other things still pending in front of her, presumably for a future disposition, future argument in front of Judge Eileen Cannon. But this past week, saying as to Donald Trump's claim that the Espionage Act is invalid and that the counts under that act should be therefore dismissed, the case should go away, rejecting that notion and handing him the first time that she's denied a legal attack on the indictment in that case. One other matter going back to Washington, D.C., I want to mention here, we're going to chat a whole lot more next broadcast about the Supreme Court. Notable that late yesterday afternoon, the Supreme Court in one of these major cases in the social media area that we've talked about in great length, a case called O'Connor Radcliffe versus Garnier, issuing a major decision on rules for blocking citizens from officials' accounts. Amy Coney Barrett, writing for the court, said two things are required before officials may be sued by people they have blocked on their personal accounts. If those are pending on a personal platform, the officials must have been empowered to speak for the government on the issues they addressed on their sites, and they must have used that authority in the posts in question. A major case. We're going to spend some time next time chatting all about that and describing in greater detail what Justice Coney Barrett has said. The case, again, is not only O'Connor Ratcliffe versus Garnier, but also Lynn Key versus Freed, a part of some larger cases that are pending in this area of social media generally that we have talked about before. The court, of course, did not apply this new standard to the cases before it, but instead sent them back to Michigan and California for the courts to apply this new standard in determining whether or not the people who were complaining about the officials who blocked them on personal accounts, those complaints based upon the First Amendment, saying that, gee, if the official has this personal account providing information, providing official government authority, statements, other information in the public domain, and I'm blocked from that, that is a violation of the First Amendment. The court not dispositively ruling on those decisions, but saying here's the standard by which you need to address those, lower court, and determining whether or not the actors, that is the government actors here, in not only setting up their personal accounts, doing what they do on those personal accounts, posting things about their own involvement and the matters that are in the scope of government domain, whether that's state action sufficient to make the First Amendment claims legitimate. So those cases, again, coming out yesterday, an awful lot more coming out down the road, including other matters having to do with social media, the interaction between states and social media providers, and indeed the executive branch in an attempt to influence and have an impact upon what is appearing on those social media platforms. In our final minutes today, I want to talk about a major programming note, and that is that next week, as we always are, we're going to be coming to you again through the broadcast stations of Civic Media. But our broadcast is going to sound and appear to you a little bit different. First of all, we're changing the name. The name of our broadcast beginning next Saturday, the 24th, is going to be Amicus, a Law Review with Jim Santel. Amicus, a Law Review. I'm going to tell you more about the name of our new program. But it'll also reaffirm that in fundamental ways, the content, the substance of our program is not going to change. As always, we're going to focus upon what happened, some of the major exposition of the stories in law and government, delivery of justice. We'll explain the reasons why these things have happened. We're going to go into those things in detail, as we did today. We're going to examine the practical trappings, as we have always done, specific aspects of government action. And we're going to provide some instruction, maybe some perspectives, on the intersection of the law with civic responsibility and engagement in the community. As always, we're going to do things like undiscovered justice, things that are not in the main public broadcast areas. The mainstream media may have overlooked some of this. We're going to talk about rule of law snapshots, brief issues that are in the news in the area of justice for you to know about. We're going to talk about microscopic justice. That is the kinds of things we did today in understanding in depth the things that are important to our understanding of the law. And we're also going to talk about something called Law Review Case Notes, a little bit more of my opinions on some of the things that are going on, the issues that we describe. Again, we're going to be restyling our broadcast a bit under the name Amicus, a Law Review. I'm going to be here. It's still going to be 9 to 11, 2 hours every Saturday morning. Always going to encourage your phone calls at 844-967-2789. The music is going to be a bit different. The intro is going to be a bit different. So when you tune in next Saturday at 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock, anticipate that that will happen. But I'm still going to be here. My wonderful producer, Johnny, is still going to be here as well as we pursue with you all of these issues related to civics, civic responsibility, law, government, and the delivery of justice, the delivery of rule of law in these United States of America. Come back and join us for Amicus, a Law Review with Jim Santel next week, beginning here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Thank you for being with me today, and have a good week, everybody.
Waukesha, home of Les Paul, our awesome farmers market, and The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK. The Maggie Dawn Show.
How to avoid this apocalyptic nightmare? It's to vote. Because at the end of the day, the only thing that will save our democracy is our democracy. America, make your voice heard. Turn away from authoritarianism and vote this November.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Allies Tax Relief.
I'm Allison Keyes.